Welcome back, Get a Grip on Lighting listeners. This is episode 46. On today's show, we had our old friend David Gordon. David's been a long time since I chatted with you, and really good to have you on the show. Greg, we covered a whole host of topics, man. I don't even know what to tell these people to listen to. We went through everything, basically.
Yeah, I'd say just listen to it. That sums it up.
Just listen. You know how we roll. Come on, folks. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by SLG. SpringLEDs.com. That's SpringLEDs.com. Greg, tell us a little about SLG.
So they're a company that's relatively new to the game, but they have a lot of high quality product. They have area lights for outdoor. They have high bays. They have floods. They have wall packs. Really everything you need. But what's different about these guys that I see from a lot of other companies making LED product is that they're coming out with new generations constantly. So they have one generation and they keep adding to it and expanding on it and making it better. And their product really is high quality. They do offer a 10-year warranty on it, and they have DLC listings for it, and they have great optics on all their fixtures. So some real quality product to take a look at on their website.
And you know, you were saying that they want us to tell the listeners that if you want to know more about SpringLEDs.com's products, you can go to their website, SpringLEDs.com. Is that with an S, Greg? SpringLEDs.com?
Yeah, with an S.
Okay, so SpringLEDs.com. Scroll down to their YouTube channel, click on it, maybe subscribe if you're into it, but watch their product videos, check them out, and see, you know, what offerings they have. They have a whole bunch of different YouTube videos, case studies, stuff like that on that channel, so you can check out their YouTube channel. I think we'll put a link to it on the website, on the GetAGripOnLighting.com website, and you can click it there as well. And this episode of the show and every episode of the GetAGripOnLighting.com website is brought to you by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Should we just go to episode 46 right now, Greg?
Let's roll it.
Boom. Welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, David Gordon.
Good morning. How are you? See, I'm still in morning time.
That's okay. We'll get you out of it by the end of the show. Say hi to Greg Garrett.
How you doing, Greg? Long time no see.
It has been a while. Good to see you. Thanks, David.
You know, I think the last time we spoke, you were handed in the board of directors that nailed a 90-page report. And you know what it was missing? It didn't say in chapter...
You needed to have video interviewing.
Nah, you got to start a podcast and put that Michael Colligan in charge of it. That's the only thing was missing, David. So
we did put you in charge of recruitment.
They did, unfortunately for them. Well, it is what it is. So, David, tell us a little bit about what Channel Marketing Group does.
Well, Channel Marketing Group works with manufacturers and distributors and manufacturer reps, and actually with some technology companies now, with our focus into the electrical and lighting space. We've done it for the last almost 19 years. We also run the industry blog, Electrical Trends, that we've had running for 11 years. So we're really helping companies on their strategy, their marketing, their market research, and really initiatives to try driving growth.
Yeah. Who's your primary client then? Is it the manufacturing side, distributing side, manufacturing rep?
Well, the business really actually changes annually. It's typically about 40-60 split one way or the other, depending upon the year. So we get good insights into both sides of the market so we can craft the win-win solutions for each side. It's not so much then becomes a we-they, and we don't have a, let's say, a manufacturer-only mentality. To give you an example, I was actually at a lighting manufacturer about 2.5-3 weeks ago, one of the conglomerate companies, and they have their opinions. They interact with distributors, but they don't really know distributors. And we had a very candid conversation, and I said, you know, some of the strategies you guys are thinking about, they're going to be DOA. And they were asking why. I said, this is the way distributors think. This is the way they're looking at you. This is what's going on in the market. Do you guys want to compete against other conglomerates or compete in the lighting space? So we'll be very direct with some of these people and give them that distributor perspective, or also in some of the instances, you got to give them the rep of the lighting agent perspective. And that's different than what they're used to.
You know, would you say,
$1 million.
I would say the conglomerates, and I'm not going to say who they are, but we all know who we're talking about here. And then the big three have basically ceded the space to distributors, to new players, or given up a lot of market share by not respecting the go-to-market processes of distributors.
No, I wouldn't say it that way, Mike, because you got to really break it down by customer segment and project type, because they still have lots of strength in the large project new construction market. That's really where they have a lot of expertise.
But the distributors, a lot of the independent lighting distributors are operating in the renovation space.
Right, and that's where I was going to get, is when you get into the renovation, especially more the small to mid-size, with the increased number of competitors in those spaces, the commoditization of product, the fact that LED products really changed the overall business model, yes, they've given up a lot there on share. And sometimes that share issue is just on the product side, because the lighting agent wasn't calling on those end customers. So the distributor and those who've invested into the lighting side, they can control more of that. Now, I don't know so much up in Canada, but at least down here in the States, a number of the conglomerates have now come out with what I'll call repackaged of their more commodity-oriented products, and are trying to win back some of that business from a pricing perspective. But they get a long way to go. And maybe the only thing that might help them right now is the tariffs.
We're going to get into the tariffs.
Get into that.
We're going to get into it. Don't worry. Go ahead, Griggy.
But the thing about tariffs is it's artificial pricing increase too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's dive in right now. We're on it. Tell me about the tariffs. We talked a little bit about it actually yesterday, Michael and I, and just tried to figure out, you know, what this is all about. To me, it kind of seems like an opportunistic thing where they can take advantage of a price increase when they've been lowering prices for the last couple of years. Is that what you feel is going on, or do you feel like there's a legit concern, a legit argument that there is going to be a significant price increase to the lighting manufacturers?
It's going to be actually along that entire continuum, Greg. And some of that comes down to timing and how long the tariffs may be, if they're here forever. In the short term, you know, it's just like when a distributor has wire. They're putting on price increases quickly, but they've got material sitting in warehouses. So they're going to make some money on that, but they're looking at replacement costs coming in, so therefore they're increasing it. Typically happens in the wire environment on a regular basis. The challenge is that they're calling every price increase, they're adding the word tariff to it. So what percent of every increase has tariffs? What percent is just a price increase? And it would be interesting to ask these manufacturers, what percent of your material is coming from China, either finished or assembled pieces? What comes from Mexico? What comes from XYZ country? Because if you've noticed, the increases that have been announced so far, and there were some written on, published on Edison Report last week, they're all over the spectrum. I mean, I think I've seen anything from 6 to 14%. Why so much of a range?
Okay, so
how much
are
some of these companies taking?
Okay, so complexity aside. Okay, so tariffs are, and ethics aside, because I don't believe tariffs are ethical, but that's a whole other conversation. Okay, so complexity aside, what is being tariffed? Components, metals, plastics, general categories, or everything? Is there a flat tariff on anything that's coming on a boat from China and landing in the continental United States or landing in the United States? Anything coming from China, or is it just components inside it? What are the tariffs? How do they work, and how much is it? Can you answer those questions?
No. Just because I'm not a tariff expert. However, there are specific products, and in talking to manufacturers, I have heard everything from assembled parts, assembly pieces, to finished product. And it may change by product category. I just got off a call that had about a dozen manufacturers on it, multiple industries, but one manufacturer in the electrical industry, he talked about tariffs on circuit boards to entire digital timers. So it's really something that just gets down into the details of the tariff regulation specifically.
So, and what's the tariff on? Is it on their landed cost?
And that's part of the...
Is it on their landed cost? Like, let's say it costs them $4 to land an LED T8 tube. Is the tariff 10%? Is the tariff 15%? Is it 16%? And then are they taking that same percentage and putting that on their... Are they passing that percentage through? Because if they're charging me $7 or $10 for that particular piece of material, if they put 10% on it or the same amount as the tariff, it certainly seems to be more than covering their cost, Mr. Gordon.
There's multiple things that go into their costs. All right, because these manufacturers have also had labor cost increases, corrugated box increases, freight increases, a number of other things that they're trying to recoup at the same time. Plus, they have the steel and aluminum tariffs that went into effect earlier in the year, and every supplier has different percentages there. I've got a tool client who back in July, there were three boats on the water that had material for him, that when the July tariffs went into effect, since it wasn't landed, all of a sudden, his costs on those materials, depending upon whether it was a tool or was a tester, went up 10 to 25% overnight. Now, he had already sold that material. There's a portion of that increase that he ends up eating because he's already sold it for a price. So with the tariffs and then talking to manufacturers, it's not a case of just strictly passing it on. They're going through some very complex formulas and then also having some commercial decisions of what percent of that they want to pass. It is where I think it will get a little bit interesting longer term. So you look at these Chinese companies that, and you know, I hate to say Chinese because so many of them source there too, but
how
companies that are really, but you know, you got some of these companies that are really just sales fronts that have been 10 to 15% lower. Are they going to stay 10 to 15% lower? And, or are they going to absorb it? And do they really mentally think about running a business from a profitability viewpoint the same way that a publicly held company or you or Greg think about how to run the business from a profitability viewpoint? Because could they lose their price differential, which helps them get share?
And
then there's distributors right now who are also tracking every tariff that gets mentioned because they think that if the tariffs go away 3 months, 6 months, our manufacturer is going to drop pricing. Or will they keep it as incremental profit? And tariffs are not necessarily bad for distributors because as long as you maintain your margin percent, it's more GP dollars.
As long as you maintain that, that's the real key. But yeah, I don't know that all manufacturers are going to jump on this. I mean, I know the bigger ones are right now, but the smaller ones I could see kind of going by and absorbing it is what I think will happen. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But we've been trying to get somebody on from a manufacturer to talk more about these specifics, and so far nobody has agreed to. Is it just we're too new in the process still? Or is it
too
that
much
they don't want to share?
Or,
yeah, what is it?
Well, it's a case of right now, especially over the last couple of weeks, it's been too new in the process because they don't know what they were going to do. Right now, they're in the process of finalizing all of this because it goes into effect on the 24th and they have to get the messaging into the channel. It changes by channel partner because based upon the relationship that a manufacturer may have with especially larger distributors, they may not be able to put any price increases through for 30, 60, 90 days because they have to give advance notice. So that creates differentiation of what will happen there too. You know, and the other part of the reality, Greg, is they don't want to share too much of what their corporate strategy might be.
Right.
Let me ask you, this is just a personal interest question, and it's completely anecdotal, but like, don't you think tariffs are wrong, David Gordon?
I think that's begging into the whole issue of what is trying to be done politically.
I mean, like, there's only three reasons to raise
tariffs.
How's
that for a non-committal answer?
Yeah, I'm not going to let you get away with that. So there's only three reasons. Welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast, David Gordon. There's only three reasons for tariffs. One is for the government to raise income.
Is predatory pricing good?
No, it's not predatory. The second would be to negotiate trade deals. And the third would be to protect industry in the United States or within the country that has the tariffs. So number one, there's no lighting industry in the United States except for fixtures. So if we're talking about putting tariffs on LED tubes, I guess there is a protectionist move to protect American manufacturers against Chinese competition. That would be one. The second would be to negotiate a better trade deal. And the third would be to raise income for the federal government, which I believe is non-progressive and unethical way to raise income. But nonetheless, those are the three reasons to have tariffs. Which one do you think it is?
It's the middle one. It's a way to negotiate the trade deal / I'll say fairer trade practices.
Okay.
Now, so the thing is that the issue gets much broader than just in lighting.
Right, but no, we're in the lighting business here, so people can extrapolate to other industries if they want. Do you think the United States lighting business needs protection from Asian manufacturers?
We don't have much of a lighting business anymore.
There's some manufacturers out there that sponsor this podcast, but I'm certain a lot of their components do partial of the fit that go into the fixture. Some of the components are from Mexico, like you said, China, but there is manufacturing in the United States for luminaires. For replacement LED bulbs, I would say very minor. But does the U.S. want to protect their industry and then perhaps use tariffs to grow local manufacturing of lighting products? Is that part of it?
I don't know if we limit it to lighting. I don't even know if the industry really can grow a lighting industry here, because with the evolution of LED over the past, 6 to 10 years, so much of the industry, A, has migrated to Asia, and B, the ownerships of those companies have gone away. Years ago, I wrote a blog posting on the death of the big three lamp companies. Now you look at those companies and one of them is already owned by an Asian firm. Another is being reportedly sold to an Asian firm, or at least is gaining interest there. And the third is Philips being Signify. So that industry has migrated differently. Part of it's because of the technology. Part of it is because it became a race to the bottom on the price side. And even when someone like Cree that started here in the U.S. and started doing all the manufacturing in the U.S., now they took it all over to China to get the cost advantages.
So we toured a Chinese factory.
So I don't think it can be strictly as it relates to the lighting industry, because also we all know that from a governmental perspective, they don't think industry specific unless it's how do we protect Apple.
I don't know if Apple
is excluded from the tariff.
I'll tell you this, man, that company's worth $1 trillion. It isn't out of the time frame before companies like Apple and Amazon start thinking, how do we protect the United States? I mean, put your 10-year hat on, and that little question might get inverted, and you might be like, these massive corporations might be looking at saying, how do we protect the U.S.? But that's a whole other conversation. What I would say is this. I think there's a colossal shift in manufacturing going on right now in the world, And that shift plays itself to being closer to the end market of the destined goods. And the reason why is that one of the reasons why all the manufacturing migrated to China is because U.S. labor was so expensive. And it's another reason why it migrated to Mexico. It's not why it came to Canada. We have high labor costs here too. don't blame Canada.
And we won't talk about your healthcare costs.
We could do a podcast on that. I'm pretty familiar with that. I'm surprised that Donald Trump hasn't come forward and said the Canadian healthcare system is a subsidy and should be kicked into NAFTA. That would be an excellent trading strategy for him if he was able to come across that, because it actually is a subsidy. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. If we look at the way that they manufacture lighting in the future, and anything in the future, is going to be highly automated. And so that is a complete shift away again. So instead of having 500 people there, you know, I'm rivet number 33 and 36, he's rivet number 37 and 38 or whatever, and so on down the line, and you have 500 people sitting there making, you know, 50 cents a day with no bathroom breaks. You know, U.S. guys are never going to do that. I seen these factories with my own eyes and how they all sit in these rows and they live there and they eat there and they work, you know, 6 days a week and whatever. The last line that Greg and I saw was an automated line. And there was, what, four people in that room, Greg? How many people were in that room?
Yeah, it was about four, if that.
Yeah, so from 500 to four. And you had one end input stuff going into it, out the other end finished lighting products. And now what you have is the gigantic Pacific Ocean to get it across. I think that there's an argument that you could bring back automated lighting manufacturing right in Texas or Iowa or somewhere, Ontario, why not, right back onto this continent, and the cost would be in the favor. So it'd be the opposite. You could produce low cost, high quality lighting products right here in the United States. And if the purpose of the tariffs was to encourage that, I don't know if that's a bad thing for the United States of America. And I don't know if Canada could get on board with that. I don't know if that's a bad thing for Canada either. That would create a lot of.
The thing is, we haven't heard from any manufacturers that they're thinking long term and being willing to make those types of investments. And part of the challenge may be that they've gotten kind of like heroin addicts. They're hooked on the concept that they can change products every 6 to 9 months, worst case a year, because they're sourcing it from someone in China. And the reality is those factories then have 18 different boxes with other companies' names on them. So have they gotten so used to that cycle and not investing back into their business to spend X millions of dollars into those factories? Because if they did what you're saying, it could be a boom for everyone. Question is, do they think that way, especially when you get Wall Street and thinking quarterly? Are they thinking from investment? Because I've also talked to some manufacturers that at the same time are contract manufacturers, and they talk about their China operations and how the cost at their China operations have increased due to healthcare, OSHA, labor costs, things like that. And they're talking about looking at Vietnam, looking at Africa as the next lowest cost place to go to. And the only reason they haven't pulled the trigger is because it's not the supporting infrastructure in those areas, in the sense of getting enough labor, getting the packaging, having
the supply chain is not in place. The supply chain is not in place. In China, you have cardboard manufacturers, you have lamp manufacturers, you have plastics.
About the mentality.
But in America, you have plastics manufacturers, you have aluminum manufacturers, you have cardboard manufacturers. Yeah, all the issues that you have in Vietnam and Mozambique and Angola and all these other areas that people are looking at, oh, here's the next cheap labor boom. Well, number one, we don't need cheap labor anymore. We don't need that. Right. The machines make the whole thing anyway. All we need is one person with a clipboard at one end, and maybe even the forklift driver is going to be automated. So the
Steel Power Tools?
Yeah, sure.
STIHL.
Yeah.
They opened a factory a couple of years ago in southeastern Virginia. They got their total costs down to within 2% of what they were doing in China before, inclusive of bringing everything over the water and things like that. So companies that have vision can do exactly what you're saying. challenges is how many of them will have fish.
Well, the problem is they're not manufacturers anymore. They're distributors. So that's the fact. So, it's really distributors selling to distributors. So, I don't know I shouldn't say it. Some of them do have a lot of manufacturing expertise in-house. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to see if somebody stepped back and said, you know what, we can do this right here in Pennsylvania, or we can do it right here in Iowa, and we can crank it out. And we are also going to build in the flexibility into this manufacturing facility that will allow for quick, with 3D printing or whatever it would be, would allow for very quick product cycles. And there's companies have done that in other industries. Clothing is an example. The company Inditex was able to make very swift manufacturing changes to make different types of clothing and jeans and all this. So the equipment and the software and the machines are out there to do this. I don't see any reason why they can't stick two end caps on a piece of plastic with an LED strip in it, David Gordon.
Well, come on, where you need to go? I think we should send you to the NEMA annual meeting in November.
Get a grip on light. He's going to roll in hot.
Need to hear that. But the manufacturers need to hear that and need to understand that there is a benefit of doing.
Well, and I think if there's a certain environment.
And it would play on Wall Street.
I don't know anything about banksters. That's what I call them. The banksters down on Wall Street, whatever games they play, it always seems like it's a game they always get to win. Where it's rigged in their favor, so they can kind of kiss my ass. But other than that, if there was some certainty in the environment for people to invest, and if that certainty was tariffs, then I think you remove the ethical barriers that are involved with tariffs. If the idea is to make the playing field level, then I think that's smart trade policy, and I think that they should do the tariffs and announce them for that reason. But in terms of the lighting business and raising prices on me, we'll see how that works. I mean, I don't buy that much of that stuff in the U.S., but I mean, Greg, I mean, yeah. I kicked this donkey too hard. I don't know if we should move on to another topic, but I mean, for me,
what are you saying from your suppliers?
Canada's not putting up any tariffs.
But what is it, Greg, what are you, you're down here in the States, correct?
It's just the bigger name manufacturers, and it's not really anything that I'm too concerned about at this point. But yeah, that's all I'm seeing is that there is a potential. Some say a potential increase, some say a 6% or whatever, and kind of just putting warnings out there. But I'm not really too concerned about it until I see more, real stats on what it's all about and how it will affect me.
Have you seen any customers that might have significant projects that are for either protection if they give you the business now and then the order comes later, or
not at this point? I haven't seen that yet, but I could see that coming down the line, where it might be an issue. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's been more on the fixture side that I've seen it than on the lamp replacement side and things like that. But again, some people are saying general, some are saying certain things.
And the lamp replacement side continues to decline from a unit perspective.
For sure.
Decline in price.
And growth, maybe. Yep.
And growth as well. So we're going to see a decline in retrofit products, pricing, and in growth of the business. That's interesting. That's the first time I've heard anyone say that.
We're not saying decline in retrofit projects. We're saying decline in just replacement lamps.
Oh, for sure.
Because what happens, so then they're going to a fixture instead.
Or they're going to a tube that lasts 50,000 hours.
Lamps used to be a 5% of a distributor's business, sometimes even higher. And that's kind of like rolling off the side of the table.
It was a hell of a lot more than 5% in my business.
For a lighting distributor, sure was.
Right. I'm looking at full line distributors, line electric.
Yeah, electrical. Michael talked about manufacturers saying there really isn't any, there is no such thing anymore. They're all distributors, but we still call them that. What, in your definition, David, what would you say is a lighting manufacturer? If you had to sum it up.
Boy, that's a loaded question, Greg.
I understand.
That's someone. That's someone who's built a brand over a group of categories or product offerings to bring it to market and sells it through a sales organization to have it broken down. You know, I hate to say it that way because we all know certain manufacturers who source 100% of the stuff that they sell. And their value proposition is their sourcing expertise, hopefully some QC, demand forecasting, and quite frankly, taking the risk of aggregating that material to then break it down and ship it to you / your customers in smaller quantities. And they put some branding around it that may or may not have value to you or to a customer. But it gives you a single point of contact for an array of products, just like your customer looks at you as a single point of contact for an array of product. In your case, that product could be dissimilar. And the reason I say dissimilar is think like a full line distributor. You know, he could be placing an order that's got switch gear, wire, connectors, boxes, and fixtures. When they're placing that order with you, that bill of materials could have 10 different lighting manufacturers on it based upon their need. Mm. So it's aggregating that to the next level. Then you get obviously some manufacturers who are manufacturing and or do some product modification if necessary for that application. So you get really three different dynamics there. Now, the challenge you have with some of the Asian companies that have come about is a number of them were contract manufacturers to, let's say, name brands that we all know, who then decided, oh, we want to go after more of that share and migrate up. So they're acting as a contract manufacturer to an OEM and also acting as a direct manufacturer. As we know, the better manufacturers help create demand for you. They'll do some of the training, they'll do end user, things like that. So you got to look at it nowadays from a distributor viewpoint. You got to say, all right, is this a supplier that adds value to me, or is this a supplier that really is a transactional environment for just placing orders and getting material? And you know, he can add value, quote unquote, back of the house to get me the price. He doesn't add any value in either capturing the order or selling the order.
And this referring customers both. To you and yeah. And referring customers. Right. I mean, you know, in the old days, our big suppliers would send us, you know, 5-10 customers a month. And that stopped happening a long time ago. But that's because they're not. The relationship between somebody who has a capital intensive manufacturing operation and a distributor who has a warehouse that he stocks in the relationship between those two things is very natural. I want to sell what I've made right away so I can cover the cost of capital, and I don't have a big warehouse where I am or whatever. And the distributor's like, well, I want some sort of exclusive rights or preferential pricing in order for me to stock this. That model's long gone, man.
Those models are long gone. What percent of your purchases are from lines that have lighting agents versus lines that have supply reps?
I don't use any lighting agents. I don't like lighting agents, but I mean, I've had bad experiences with them. Now, sorry to all the agents that are out there listening to the show. I love you. Nothing but love. Press play on the Get a Grip on Lenny podcast. But, you know, I found that the relationships with agents were always fraught with peril. I preferred to deal directly with the company I'm working with. Greg, what about you? You seem to use more agents than me.
I think it's just natural, maybe in our area that we have agents. Whether I actually use the agents or not is another story. I would say majority of the lines we buy have an agent, but a majority of my relationships are directly with the manufacturer of the product. I just bypass the agent. They get a certain percentage on it for basically doing nothing, because a lot of them that I've worked with can't really provide much value for me. I know more about, and I'm not saying I'm the smartest, but I know more about their product than the agent does. because I deal with it every day, and they have multiple lines and they do whatever else they do, but they don't really bring any value other than, hey, what's my price and is it available?
And if I would I take a I would take a strong I would take a strong smart order desk guy any day over at the person's warehouse or wherever, any day over a lighting agent.
Well, and I think what's also changed in that whole lighting agent world is the lighting agents now carry more lines than they ever did. Mm-hmm. Versus supply rep, you know, he might have 1 to 5 lighting lines that are typically more renovation oriented. But the lighting agent who spends more of his time at the end user side or at the specifier side, he's got 50, 75, 100 different lines. Who's he beholden to? Is he even trying to create demand for the manufacturer?
No. Right. His wallet, like Michael said. That's exactly right. And that's one of the things that, you know, we kind of emailed about initially is who you can really trust in this industry and who to get you the right product. Because I look at a lot of manufacturing reps and I've attempted to trust them in the past, and they come in and they say, hey, this company's new, but they're going to be around. They have all this backing. Here's their pricing. Here's their availability. They're going to be here for the long run. Look at this. This is great. And I say, oh, great. You know, I'll look at it. A couple months go by. Maybe I buy a little bit of product. And then 3 months later, they say, oh, that company's junk. I'm done with those guys. So that to me, that throws manufacturing reps right out the window for me. I want to deal with the manufacturer of the product that I can have that relationship with. So I know, you know, face-to-face if I can trust them. I've seen that more and more lately because these manufacturing reps have so many different companies they rep, and a lot of them cross over to different product lines.
Yeah, I've called up a manufacturing rep when I've had to buy a specific fixture, Greg. I'll call the guy up, and like I'll call the company that makes it. Say, I'm not going to say who, but let's say company X in Iowa. And I'll say, yeah, well, we're really interested. I really love this product. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Use our agent in Toronto was this agency. I'll call them up and say, hey, yeah, you know, Jimmy from company X down in Iowa told me to call you about this product. You'll be like, yeah, thanks for that. Actually, I got a better brand than them. You can use these other guys who make the same thing as they do, and I happen to have it in my warehouse right now. You know what? I don't know, whatever it is. It's, you know, it's already landed in Ontario. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, you just totally betrayed your manufacturing rep relationship to me. Why would I ever trust you? Like, that's right. Like, if these guys are paying you and you are betraying them, why would I want to swim in those waters with you? Come on, man. Get it.
Probably go. Because he was making a higher commission on the other company.
Exactly.
I mean,
I was at it to that point, though, Michael. I was at a distributor branch manager meeting back in January, and they've got 30 branches. Two branch managers were talking about a particular fixture. They both brought it into the meeting. Two different manufacturers, exactly the same fixture. Look, color, performance, the whole nine yards. You knew they came out of the same factory, and there was a difference in price. And they were stocking, this distributor was stocking both in their warehouse without realizing it.
Gotta love
so
it.
You know what was a 5-minute conversation during that meeting of, all right, guys, which one of these should we stock? Do we care? And everyone's hand went up for whichever one was cheaper. And it was cheaper by $5.
I'll take the five bucks. Thank you very much.
How the market's going.
$5 is better in my pocket. You know,
because the other part of trust, Greg, is would you even trust them at your customer?
Right. No.
If they're gonna do whenever that to whenever you, anybody asks me for a job name, that's the first lie of the day. Hey, yeah, I want to order 276 of that fixture and 50 of those. And oh yeah, what's the job name? Yeah, like I'm gonna tell you, buddy. Come on, man. Really? You think I'm that dumb? Yeah. I'm not telling you anything. It's ABC Company at 123 Street. Thanks. Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
And in the old days, it was different.
It's not me that sabotaged the trust. I paid everybody. So that's on the agents have sabotaged that in my market. I don't trust any of them at all. So I would never tell them who my customers are. I would say that my people and me know more about the product that I'm trying to buy from them than they do. And they've pulled enough stunts over the years that, you know, hey, I'm done with, I don't want to deal with lighting agents unless I absolutely have to. So there's a, there you are to lighting agents. Sorry, guys, for all the listeners out there.
The two of you just brought up a key issue for a lot of distributors. You're talking about how educated your inside salespeople, primarily, maybe outside salespeople, how educated they've become on product to therefore be more knowledgeable slash, I'll say, have intellectual curiosity to go out and identify an appropriate product. How are you guys doing that? Because there are distributors all across the conundrum, all across the pendulum on that. There are people who have the lighting specialists who are good, and then there's other ones who, if you don't give them the SKU number, they have no idea what it is. So how are you keeping your staffs educated?
Well, from my standpoint, it's all about, you know, first of all, product knowledge and having some basic background on what's out in the marketplace, and then what makes sense in place of that. And we have manufacturers and manufacturing reps come in and talk to us and explain their projects, their products, and, you know, analyze spec sheets, test product when we need to, and then kind of make decisions from there. So knowing what works, knowing, you know, who you can trust to back what they say, who has some reputation, who's going to be around long enough to honor their warranties, you know, who lumens per watt, you got to look at efficiency. So kind of everything. And then also options. I like to a lot of times go into a place and sell more of a concept. Like, I'm going to give you bypass tube, or I'm going to give you a LED insert, and then I'm going to figure out which one's the best one for you, you know, based on who's going to have it available, whose price is going to be good, who's going to have all the Kelvin temperatures you need, so that you can sell the customer. Then you can say, all right, what color do you want? And I know that this manufacturer is going to have that covered. That's me, what I personally like to do.
I think it's deeper than that. I think it's deeper than that, Greg. I think, and you've talked about it on this show, I think we come at lighting retrofits, the lighting projects, the same way. I think it comes down to how you train your staff and whether or not they're soldiers in the trenches or if they're standing back on white towers and trying to tell people what to do. And I think that's why this podcast is successful, because you have two guys that are in the trenches every day selling people light bulbs to the end user, to the person who screws them in or the person who has them in their factory or whatever. And so that knowledge is very difficult to acquire when you're not facing and standing in front of the customer. The second point is that I think what Greg and I both do and teach our staff to do is that we look at things from the customer's perspective. Like, if you only sell a wrench, a hammer, if you only have a hammer, then a hammer, everything's a nail, right? But if you're a sophisticated brand agnostic distributor, electrical contractor, whatever positioning you are in the market, but if you're brand agnostic, you're technology agnostic, and you're looking out for the best interests of your customer, you make choices, you provide options to them which are in their fundamental best interest, and not what you have in your warehouse, not what SKU number you want to move, not, you know, we're pushing product A this month. Product A's got to get out the door. Go out there and, you know, push product A. You don't learn when you're a product pusher. You learn when you're a solutions finder, when you listen to your client, when you want what's best for them for those reasons. That's when you're learning. And I think what Greg and I do in the field, and what a lot of people in Nailed do, and a lot of other people that listen to this show do, is they're concerned about what's best for their client and giving them the most cost-effective, efficient system that's going to generate the biggest rebate for them, and that is going to last long. And we know for sure that if something doesn't work out, the manufacturer is there to back them up, and all this kind of stuff. That this is what distributors put together. This is what strong project-based distributors put together for their clients. And when people are at the other end of the business, and the white towers at the other end, saying, "Well, come on, man. Well, how come the color temperature is not even real anymore, man? I heard that last week. There's no color temperature anymore. We're coming up with a new scale now." Like, who cares, lighting dork? How many light bulbs do you ever sell to anybody? Nothing. You never sold a light bulb to anybody in your life. Well, come on, man. We got to talk about the lighting dork stuff. What about the foot candle? What about the projection? I got the software. I can put the fixtures in the software and it punches out a number of this. Get out of here, buddy. Like, I'm not against any of that sort of stuff. Yeah. But that's what manufacturers do. They think that what matters is, you know, what they know about their products. And what matters is what I know about their products. And what I tell customers.
What really matters is what the customer needs.
Yes. Yes. And you know, like I said, if you only have a hammer, everything's a nail. So, you know, and so I think what Greg does very well, better than me, is he equips his people to have lots of tools in their tool belt. And he provides them with a concept that, and I do this as well. I just don't have as many people as Greg. But provides them with the concept that is, look, let's listen to the customer. Give them a solution that works for them. And that is in their best, fundamental best interest, that has nothing to do with any particular brand or technology. And that, you know what, that's it's interesting that a lot of lighting distributors that I know avoided induction lighting like the plague. That's a perfect example. Greg, how many induction lighting projects did you do?
Three.
Zero.
Yes.
Zero, yeah. Right?
I did three because of customer preference. Gave them the option and they chose it.
Right. I mean, the reason why, like, so many people like Greg and I just independently decided not to go near induction is because the induction is like a hammer. There's only one fixture. There's no replaceable parts except from one manufacturer. So these guys have their issues with what's going on in the front lines because they're not on the front lines. And if they were, they would figure out very quickly that you have to be customer focused. And our customers are the people that actually use the light fixtures or the light bulbs or whatever it is, the solution that you're selling them. So, of course, we're going to be more sophisticated than them. David Gordon, come on, man.
Well, the thing is selling a solution versus marketing that you're solution finders and that you're brand agnostic is something different from most distributors. Because to your point, most distributors go out and they market, we're an XYZ distributor, or they go out and market a particular product versus for the application and or that they're the solution provider. And most distributors have really not done a good job of training their sales organizations to think like that, so that when they're not, quote unquote, knocking on doors to create business, they're able to communicate a value proposition, or, you know, if you're doing e-marketing and direct marketing, so that you're communicating that value proposition. Distributors can be very good at, you know, let's go back to the hammer and the nail. They can be very good when a specific thing comes about, they can nail it. And eventually most of them will get to the point of price.
Well, there's no money
to go and do and buy the business versus
we still
addressing
do
objections and selling value.
We still do that every day. Greg, people call up and say, hey, excuse me, could I get a case of F32T8 850K? You get those every day, right, Greg? Mm-hmm. Ship them out the door?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no money in that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no money in that. You want that? That's not like you're not going to make, you're not going to be able to get them. Maybe you can make some money, but the big money is in the solutions. And right now the money's in, that's why we're all rebate chasers basically, because the big money is in the selling people lighting systems based on energy efficiency and rebates. That's where the money is. Wouldn't you say, Greg?
That's what I would say, but I was going to ask David, with all your market research and the people you deal with, is it growth in new construction or is it in renovation, or have you had any good stats on that, on remodels versus new?
We've got some good stats on it. Actually, this week we're doing a survey within the industry of how Q3 performance was and what people's expectations are for Q4. And we asked them how their growth has been by customer segment. So renovation is number one, small and mid-size. Industrial lighting is number three. Large project, new construction, it's the laggard, but there we've seen correlations as it ties to major metropolitan areas. So if that makes sense there. So we're seeing of where the market is there. Now, as it relates to rebates, that's getting a little bit different. And the tariffs actually could have an impact on where rebates were in the process of going. Because we've had conversations with some of the utilities over the past year, and they were getting more and more concerned that the price of lighting continued to decline And the purpose of the rebate was to be a subsidy to stimulate adoption. And that's when, I think we'll go back a couple of years when the price of all the fixtures were much higher. As the price of the fixtures drop, the intent is not for people to get projects for free. So they were, a number of the utilities have been thinking, should we be taking our rebate monies, not so much reducing the amount of rebate, but should we be rebating other things, getting more into controls, into the daylight harvesting and things like that versus strictly on a fixture. Now, it could be that, you know, with tariffs increasing the price of everything, that holds off that discussion for another year. But if the price of a fixture continues to decline, you're going to see the some of the rebate money start going away.
Gotcha. Yeah, for sure. And it already is going away in a lot of markets. I think there's been several U.S. states that have ended their rebate programs, Greg, if I'm not, wasn't Corey telling
some
us that Arizona?
Yeah, well, some don't have them. Some are definitely, including mine, are decreasing a lot of their rebates for next. But yeah, I think that's something that is going to keep getting phased out as pricing has gone down. But now who knows if it goes back up, are they going to increase the rebates? I doubt it. I think they're kind of leveling out.
They might not increase. They need to be. They just maintain it.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that might happen for sure. One other subject I wanted to ask you a little bit too, just in your market research, is on consolidation within the industry. And we know it's happening to some degree. Do you think it's going to be more prevalent as we go, or is it going to kind of filter out?
If it will continue, because I know there's a lot of private equity money looking at the space. Will it accelerate? Very questionable, because a lot of the product offerings that people may want, they can source. So what is that acquisition necessarily generating in the sense of an additional, what is a complementary aspect of that product line that they're acquiring that's going to give them any benefit? So there'll still be some, but a lot of the deals that have been done, they're relatively small deals.
Why is there private equity money in it then at this point?
Part of it is that there's lots of private equity money just in the marketplace in general.
Sure. Just
last week, I had 3 calls from PE firms talking about distribution and manufacturers. So they need to invest the money in something. Challenges is not enough people who are raising their hands and saying, I'm willing to sell right now. Or if they want to sell, the price that they want, their business doesn't justify. It's just money sitting on the sideline, and what do you put it into?
What about the sale of GE, say, to the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragons? Is that going through? I mean, is it 100% sold? The lighting division's gone? I haven't checked it out on any side. I keep seeing things about it that it's sold, it's not sold, or it's delayed, or it's extras happening, and...
Well,
that's a big deal.
It's probably the second longest sale in history after GE Industrial. It's been on the market for a while. It will get sold. They're trying to get to a point that GE can walk away and I don't want to say be satisfied, but not be embarrassed probably from Wall Street perspective. But they don't want to be in the business. They don't want to be in the core lighting side. You know, the current by GE is more than just a fixture line. So it will happen. I know some PE firms that were involved, but our friends in Asia were the leaders and quite frankly were the prohibitive favorites before a bid package was ever sent.
Well, whew, we covered a lot of topics there, David Gordon. Thank you for coming on the show. We might make you a regular contributor a couple times a year if you're interested.
Oh, I would enjoy it. I've enjoyed the conversation. These are fun.
It is fun. I probably should pull back and say that you can make money selling light bulbs. Bulbs.com does it. Mike Connors was on. I'm sorry, I got a little ranty there, folks. But yeah, I think the money's mostly in the project. So I'm sorry, I just was thinking about
it
that.
It all comes down to what your business model is.
Yeah, you know, you can make, but you have to get really good at doing it online, I think. And you got to do it that way. You can't do it the old-fashioned way, David Gordon. It's over. It's over, man. It's over for the order desk and the counter, man.
We got to be solution sellers.
Bam! All right, on that note, thanks for coming on the show, David.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a great day.
Yep.
You too. Thank you.
SpringLEDs.com. That's SpringLEDs.com, baby. SpringLEDs.com. Scroll down to their YouTube channel. They got a lot of YouTube videos on products, case studies, all this kind of stuff. If you go to the website, SpringLEDs.com, scroll down, click on the YouTube link, check them out, Greg. What do you have to say? Come on, man.
Yeah, well, in addition to that, they're going to be at Light Fair this year. They're going to have a booth there showing a lot of their product, which is always exciting. We like going to Light Fair and checking that out. And their product, speaking on behalf of that, they do cover basically everything you need from a lighting fixture standpoint. They have area lights, pole lights, some of the best I've seen personally in the industry are their area lights. They have canopy lights, they have floods, they have high bays, parking garage fixtures, they have troffers, vapor tights, wall packs, really you name it, they make it in an LED form. And that's what you need now is LED lighting, and that's what these guys are.
That's what I heard. I heard that's the wave of the future, eh? I should get into that LED stuff.
That's what it sounds like. It took us about 45 episodes or so now to figure it out, but yeah, I think LEDs are here to stay.
The incandescent bulb is gone, folks. No more incandescent. Actually, you know what? I don't know about that. I still sell a lot of 60-watt A19s. You know that?
Well, I don't, but keep rolling.
Yeah, I do. You know, we get customers. I don't know why. They want them. They want them. They sell them. Hey, man, I tell them what to buy. Sell them what they want. That's what I say, son. This episode of the show and every episode of the show on the GetAGripOnLighting.com website is sponsored by the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. That's my association. That's Greg's association. What else do you need to know? Go to NAALD.org and join. Come on, man. The first person that joins, Greg Eric is going to buy them a steak dinner. That's right. Oh. You come down to the convention, and Greg Eric's going to buy you a big T-bone tomahawk chop steak. That's right. So go to NAALD.org for information on joining and everything else. And David Gordon, thank you for coming on the show, Channel Marketing Group. You know, with David, it's interesting. He has like a panoply of observations about the industry, which always rattle my mind a bit. He's kind of like, he goes from the trenches to the high level to the trenches back and forth. So David, always a pleasure chatting with you. Hope to run into you at one of these shows coming up and around all these. We're going to so many shows. Dude, there's so many shows to go to now. Isn't there?
Yeah, they just keep adding to them. LED shows, light shows, light fairs.
There's so many light fairs and light shows. Yeah, I mean, this business is completely nuts. You know that? It's totally nuts. And
we're part of it.
And we're running it, bro. From the GetAGripOnLighting.com studios right here in Toronto, Canada. So go to GetAGripOnLighting.com. Subscribe on YouTube. Come on, folks. We love you. Peace. 46.
Written on the rectory wall, there's a sign there for all.